outside.
This is episode 11, part 2 of the Dark Side of Psychology podcast. Let's talk about paedophilia with your host, Dr. Elio Martino and Dr. Craig Harper, lecturer in human psychology and researcher in controversial decision-making and attitudes towards sexual offenders, specifically those of paedophilic nature.
Are you comfortable to keep it as a psychopathology, as a clinical issue, regardless of if you believe they need intervention or not? Are you comfortable with it being recognized clinically?
Yeah, I'm comfortable with that. Yeah, I think still having that diagnosis or that clinical label in the DSM, for example, is something that potentially is a good thing, because it gives people then an opportunity to come forward to medical professionals if they do need help. I think it gives the option for them to come forward and receive support.
So would you prefer, in terms of reducing stigma, which it sounds like you're a proponent for, although I don't want to put words in your mouth if that's not the case.
I would support that, yeah.
If we're going to keep it in a DSM and it's going to be a clinical diagnosis, would you like to see it being treated as any other issue in the DSM, such as depression, anxiety, or let's go with something a bit harder, like a personality disorder.
We don't discriminate against people based on a medical or a clinical diagnosis. I don't think we should be doing the same in terms of paedophilia. So I'm actually writing a book chapter at the moment where I'm talking about this kind of thing, and I'm still trying to grapple with the precise idea. But similar to how we wouldn't discriminate, and we have legal protections to protect against discrimination against people with, for example, mental health conditions, we don't have that with paedophilia. We don't have legal protections against discrimination or, if we're being honest, hate online against people with paedophilic sexual interests. You then get into the whole debate about whether there should be a P added to the LGBTQ+ acronym. Again, that's a hot topic that people are currently talking about. But again, I think that's another, a different political debate.
That would go a long way to basically be normalizing it. If it gets added to the acronym, it would no longer be considered deviant behavior. It would be considered niche behavior, but would be culturally appropriate or accepted into our culture.
Yeah, I mean, people use this idea of normalization of paedophilia a lot, and I'm not really sure that I truly understand what that means. What do you mean by normalizing paedophilia?
Well, in this respect, what I mean is, if it's considered a sexual accepted response in society, as in we don't discriminate against people who fit the other parts of the acronym, lesbian, bisexual, gay, we wouldn't be able to do the same for paedophiles, which means they kind of fall under a protected category. You could even say, for example, you'd be seeing paedophile parades up and down the streets like you would a gay parade, and that's actually quite celebrated in many. Do you see where I'm going with this? By normalizing,
yes,
I mean,
yeah,
society looks upon it, doesn't frown, or at least 50% don't, and say, well, it's just the way those people are, and we're going to make do.
Okay, that's really, really helpful, actually. What I would say is that when we have, for example, a gay pride march, it wouldn't be a celebration of homosexual activity. It would be an acknowledgement that people have non-heterosexual sexual interests, and that those people shouldn't be discriminated against on the basis of that sexual interest. In the same way, I wouldn't expect there to be, as you suggested, paedophile marches or paedophile parades. I think the same kind of ideas could stand, in that when we're talking about paedophilic sexual interest, irrespective of what behaviour is associated with that, because we are classifying that behaviour as child sexual abuse, and we should still be acknowledging that as child sexual abuse. It's a criminal offence, and that should not be allowed. We're looking at paedophilia as a sexual interest. Should people be allowed to discriminate against people with a paedophilic sexual interest on the basis of that uncontrollable and perhaps unchangeable sexual interest. I think it's potentially unfair on people who have that sexual interest to face that level of stigma on the basis of having that sexual interest. To be quite honest with you, I have no real issue with negative responses towards people who commit acts of child sexual abuse. If people have a paedophilic sexual interest and they're actively trying to not offend against children, if they're anti-contact people who are sexually interested in children, they should be the people who we are looking up to stop people from committing sexual offences. And I think that's where my anti-stigma approach really lies, in that those who are actively trying to not offend, those who have this sexual interest, they acknowledge that they have the sexual interest, but they're still actively trying and they work every day to prevent sexual abuse. These are the people that we typically see on Twitter, for example, who are getting barrages of abuse every day, based purely on this idea of they have a sexual interest in children and they don't want to offend. It's the they don't want to offend part for me that is the important part, and we should be promoting those voices rather than shutting them down as Twitter has been trying to do recently.
So it sounds like you're basically trying to separate discriminating against a crime versus discriminating against a predisposition. Is that true?
Absolutely.
So it sounds like from your perspective, what you mean is if we don't stop discriminating against a sexual preference, then all that's going to do is kind of stop them talking about it or owning up to it or admitting it, and therefore prevent them from getting help or seeking out communities.
That's exactly the argument I'm making. So it's a case of, so for example, if you were someone who had a sexual interest in children and you see the stigma, you see the discrimination in society, but you feel as though you need some kind of support, you need some kind of medical support perhaps. If you go to your GP, if you've got children in your home, so say for example you're in an adult relationship but you have a sexual interest in children. If you have children in that home, if you go to your doctor, you say, "Doc, I've got a problem, I'm interested in children, I need some support, I need some help." The first thing that doctor's going to do is to look at the children in your home, potentially disclose that to your partner. You then lose your relationship, you lose your children, and also you're faced with societal abuse, because obviously it's going to come out if you've split up from your partner the reason that you've split up. What this stigma does is it stops people coming forward. It stops people coming forward who could actually be really good candidates for support, really good candidates for treatment or help in the community. And it essentially, our current approach waits for people to commit an offence. And I don't think that is a particularly constructive or productive approach to preventing or reducing the incidence of child sexual offending. I think we need to be putting into place structures and processes before people commit an offence, rather than just waiting for them to abuse a child. Because what we're doing then is we create a victim in terms of that child, then we create more victims in terms of the families and the people around, the people who have committed that offence. We're costing the taxpayers money through court fees, through imprisonment fees. And we're having a lifelong effect on that individual's life in terms of he's then forever labelled as a child sexual offender. He's got the registration, the notification procedures if you're in the US as well. It just seems to be a much more constructive approach if we can reduce the stigma at the front end and encourage people, if they do have issues with their sexual interest, to come forward before they actually commit an offence. And that for me is the point behind all of the work that I do. Trying to create an environment where people who have these deviant sexual interests, if you want to call them that, be able to come forward and access help before they commit an offence.
I suspect that would be a really controversial perspective for the general population. What do you think it is about that that is so controversial that people would be really struggling to get their head around?
I think there's a certain amount of dissonance about it. So for example, if you were living next door to someone who had a sexual interest in children, it's much more easy to see them as a monstrous child abuser than it is to be, I don't know, John next door who happens to have a sexual interest in children. We have these emotional responses to paedophilia, which again we've spoken about at the start of our conversation, but it's much easier to see someone in terms of the black and white, he's a monster versus he's not, than it is to say, well, actually he's my neighbour, I go drinking with him on a Friday, but actually he's also sexually interested in children. It's easier to have the former than it is to have the latter.
Do you think a lot of people are scared?
Scared of what, exactly?
I suspect a lot of people would... Well, first of all, they'd show anger at the idea, but I think in reality they're terrified of attempting to assimilate this particular sexual preference into our society. And although I know what you're saying about reducing stigma of discrimination, I suspect a lot of people would... the issue is they'd find with that is, by reducing discrimination or the stigma attached, they're going to start to be worried that, well, what we're saying is then, if they're protected, and my children so safe, are other people's children safe, and is this going to become a normal thing now in our society? Are we, you know, if someone comes out as paedophilic, what are we to do with that information? Is it protected? You know, you can't move away from them or know where they live or take children away from them if they've got children. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, so I suppose in terms of more of a slippery slope argument, in terms of if we were to not have the stigma, not have the discrimination, does that mean that we then sanction some forms of behaviour? Maybe I personally wouldn't endorse that view. I would say that what we need to do is stop at acknowledging that this is a behaviour, this is an interest, not a behaviour. This is an interest that up to 5% of adult men have. If up to 5% of adult men have this sexual interest in children, and even if 10% of them require help or want some support, we should be offering them that support. For me, I can see why this is a controversial topic, why it's a controversial argument, and I can understand why people have particular responses to them. I don't think that those responses should be a hindrance to enacting some of these policies, though.
I was going to say, so you feel like the reason why people would find this upsetting, distressing, or controversial is because they're in a type of dissonance where they see the world in black and white, like to categorise and box things up, and this makes it very difficult to do that?
Exactly, yeah. So a lot of the research that I've done looking at attitudes towards sexual offenders, we find that those who know sexual offenders, even if it's in a personal capacity, actually have more positive views towards them, especially those who, even those who have been victimised sexually, tend to have at least equivalent, if not more positive views towards sexual offenders than those who don't know them or haven't been abused. Now, this might be because we know that a lot of sexual abuse happens between between an offender and a victim who know each other. So what that does is it breaks down this kind of stereotype, obviously not in a very nice way, of this sexual offender being some kind of monster that hides in the bushes and attacks people at night. It breaks down that stereotype, and actually it starts to make people think that actually sexual offenders could be anyone that you encounter in the general population. And it is the same kind of thing with paedophilia, in that obviously there's much lower rates of paedophilia than there is potentially sexual abuse. But actually it could be anyone that you encounter. So they could have a sexual interest in children. And again, it's just easier for people to think, well, those people who are in jail, those people who are in prison for child sexual offences, they're the paedophiles. I would know a paedophile if I saw one. And it's not quite that simple. I think that's something that people don't really understand and they don't get their head around. And that could be driving why we have these kind of quite extreme responses to them.
You may have said this, and I might be wrong here. Did you say that there was like a 50-50 chance of offending, or did I make that statistic up?
No, so less than 50% of child sexual offenders are paedophilic.
Right, that's the one.
What proportion of paedophiles actually commit offences is obviously unknown because we don't know the true rate of paedophilia. It's impossible for us to know for sure. Estimates put it around 5%, but again, they are estimates. Those estimates range.
Sorry, 5% of paedophiles commit offences?
No, 5% of men in the community have a primary or exclusive sexual interest in children, according to some estimates. So that estimate does range from anywhere between 1 and 5%, depending on which study you read.
Do you think people are just worried that they don't have faith that a paedophile will be able to abstain?
I think so, yeah. I think that's one aspect of the response. So people, and again, I think that is linked to the way that we discuss paedophilia and child sexual offending. So if you read a story about a child sexual offence in the newspaper, invariably it will be below a headline that includes the word paedophile. And we have this conflation between paedophilia and child sexual abuse that is just pervasive in society. We don't separate those two issues. I think if we were to separate those two issues and talk about them as separate issues, obviously there is a link between paedophilia and child sexual abuse. Paedophilia does motivate some child sexual abuse, and we can't deny that. But also there are a lot of paedophiles who don't commit sexual offences. And it's that conflation, I think, that leads to some of the response, or most of the response, actually, if we're being honest, to paedophilia and the stigma that surrounds that label.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of people, because the stats aren't well known, it might be that they have trouble trusting that actually most of them will be able to find another way as an outlet or to be safe in the community.
Yeah, I think that's true. So if we were to be able to present examples of paedophiles, that would be, I think, really useful. So, for example, we ran a study, it was the final study of my PhD, actually, where we played people clips from a documentary that aired in the UK called The Paedophile Next Door. And this was quite an illuminating documentary on Channel 4, where essentially it was an hour-long documentary of an interview, essentially, with someone who has paedophilic sexual interests. They openly admits to having sexual interest in children, particularly young girls, up to the age of about 6. And what we did was we played them a clip from The Paedophile Next Door, and we played another clip of an interview with James Cantor talking about paedophilia from a scientific perspective. But essentially the arguments were the same in both clips. But what we saw was that there were much more profound reductions in stigma when we played the what we call a narrative humanization clip. So the one of the paedophile talking about his own sexual interest. And we saw that reduction both at the explicit level in terms of self-reported stigma and also at the implicit level. So we got people to categorize words, so either positive or negative words, and relate them to the paedophile label as fast as they can. We saw that difference at the implicit level as well as the explicit level. We're trying to run that study again with a bigger sample of community members at the moment. So hopefully that if we can show that that is a real effect, and it lasts over time, then potentially we then open doors for production companies to write in, I don't know, characters into a soap opera, maybe a character where someone is grappling with a sexual interest in children, to see if they can have that societal effect that we know that soap operas can have. These are all options for research, options for communication that potentially this kind of research could lead to.
I think that would, the whole thing is obviously very controversial still, and I can imagine how that conversation might go to a production company and make the suggestion. Yeah, I'm thinking about this very politically charged time in which we live, the fear of backlash, just from the conservative perspective. Imagine the backlash to a production company who would attempt to integrate these narratives into their soap operas.
Yeah. Well, I mean, soap operas have been really powerful in terms of changing views about a whole range of issues. And I think that if any area or if any industry is going to be brave enough to confront this, and I think it does take a lot of bravery, then soap operas are going to have to be those who do. We can talk about this issue as long as we like, but people are not going to change their their attitudes and their views about paedophilia because they've heard someone who does research about responses to paedophilia. What they need is a tangible example of someone who actually they've already got some kind of emotional relationship with, emotional bond with, that could be a character on a TV show, who actually has that sexual interest. And that would be my hope, if we can show that this effect is true. And again, that is a big if at the moment. But if we can show that this is a real effect, that narrative humanization can lead to lower levels of stigma, what we could potentially do is incorporate that into a mainstream TV show. And again, it, like you say, it's a politically charged time, but people need to be brave about this kind of thing. If a soap in the UK was to run a storyline that involved a man with a sexual interest in children, and that encouraged 1,000 people to come forward and access help for their sexual interest in children, I think that would be a success. People would be up in arms, and I suppose the Sun and the Daily Mail would be having it on their front pages saying, I don't know, EastEnders encourages child sexual abuse or paedophilia. But actually, I think there are enough people within the field that would be able to rebut those arguments. And we would all take, to some degree, some kind of reputational hit. But I think that reputational hit in the long term, as long as it doesn't impact on the field and its validity as a whole, that short-term barrage of abuse, and I've had that on Twitter anyway, so I'm well used to that by now. That short-term barrage of abuse, if it was going to be preventing sexual abuse from 100, 1,000 people, I would take that hit for a few days, no problem.
I think everyone can agree that the more people that step forward and say, hey, this is what's going on with me and, you know, I need help or whatever, is always a good thing. And especially for our society, if we're looking at protecting people and someone says, look, I'm a danger and I don't know, I can't stop these feelings, you know, for them to come forward is only surely a good thing. I guess the biggest uphill battle is going to be if you protect those people from discrimination laws, or if you say, look, you can come forward, nothing is going to happen to you, you'll be fine, your kids won't be taken away from you, etc. Imagine a backlash would be quite severe.
It would, but we need to put those structures into place before people are coming forward and saying, look, I'm a danger. So we need to be putting them into place when people first realise that they are having issues with their sexual interests. So if we were to say to people, if you feel as though you are struggling to some degree with your sexual interest, or if you have I don't know, if you're witnessing yourself having fantasies about children, for example, that's when you come forward. You don't wait until you are a danger, because at that point, if you're coming forward and saying, I'm a danger, then, to be honest, quite comfortably, we should be taking children away from people who are coming forward saying, I'm a danger. It's the fact that that people need to come forward before they're a danger, and get that help to stop them from becoming a danger. Does that make sense?
It does, and I think to me the question is, and again this is extremely speculative, do you feel this might be the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of people just never going to go for it, or do you feel like it's just a matter of time before people agree to this?
I think it's going to be a long battle, and I think we need to... it's going to be a long-term project from those of us who are in this field trying to convince people that actually, firstly, that paedophilia is not the same as child sexual abuse. We need to break that conflation first. After that, we need to be looking at how do we communicate that actually paedophiles are not always a risk to children. And thirdly, we need to demonstrate that actually these support systems work. And we need to communicate that in an effective way. To encourage people to first accept that they're there, and then to actually use them if they need them. I think it's a structured approach that we need. We can't just go in and say, these people are paedophiles, so therefore we should not discriminate against them. We need to have that structured approach and that structured social conversation about, firstly, paedophilia and child abuse are not the same thing. The conversations that I have with students prove that we can do that relatively quickly if people are willing to actually have a conversation. I think that's going to be the biggest issue that we have at the moment, in terms of people are just not willing to have difficult conversations or even politically charged conversations with people who don't agree with them. If we can break that first cycle, and I think we are slowly getting there, maybe. I've definitely seen a little bit of an improvement in the last couple of months, I think, in that regard. But again, when it comes to paedophilia, it's one of those topics that people just don't want to talk about, because it is so uncomfortable. But that structured approach is what we need to be having, I think.
I'm just going to ask you a few vanilla questions, and then I'm going to hit you with something pretty hard and see if you want to go with it or not. You don't have to. I'll edit it out if you don't want to go there.
Okay.
So the first thing, and you're going to have to correct me on this because I just can't remember from when I was studying forensic psych at school, university. I remember one option for people was chemical castration. Is that still something that's offered in the prison service? Or?
So chemical castration is... we wouldn't necessarily call it chemical castration. So the unit that I'm currently working with are actually leading on the UK's evaluation of what's called anti-libidinal medication for sexual offenders. And what they found is that these medications do seem to reduce things like hypersexuality, sexual compulsivity, the number of times that people masturbate, the prevalence or the incidence of their sexual fantasies. So these things do tend to be effective in people who are highly sexualized, so who have this level of kind of hypersexuality. If you're referring to chemical castration in terms of people with paedophilia, again, we would need to then talk about whether child sexual abuse is something that is driven purely by something that is sexual, or if it's something that's more emotional. And again, I think there are some people for whom sexual offending is sexual, but other people for whom it's something else. It's something more emotional. So I'm not sure that a blanket policy of chemical castration would be a good thing, but I think the option should be there for people who want it.
I'm trying to remember what we learned, but as far as I remember, if you went to prison and you had a diagnosis of paedophilia and you had sexually assaulted or were caught before you could, and you were saying, look, the fantasies aren't going away, if I'm let out, this is what's going to happen. I believe at the time they were chemically castrating, or, okay, maybe it wasn't that severe, but they were putting something in their food so that they had no sexual urges whatsoever. Am I incorrect in that?
I'm not sure. I know at the moment it's an elective treatment. So it's not a blanket policy of if someone is a hypersexual paedophile that they would automatically get this. It would be an elective treatment at the moment.
Right, I was convinced from that what we learned, but it was not actually elective, it was compulsory if you wanted to be released.
That's not my understanding. I might be wrong.
You would know. You'd know better than me. So if you're saying it's not a thing, it's not a thing, that's fair enough. So if someone did commit a sexual offence, paedophile committed a sexual offence and they were in prison, can they be released if they knew that they were still a threat? If they served their time?
Well, if they served their time, if they were on a determinate prison sentence where they had a specific release date, then yes, they would be released, but they would then be hopefully monitored in the community because they would be subject to registration laws, for example. But yeah, they would still be released if they had a determinate release date.
Right. Okay. This is the one I want to hit you with, and it broadly goes to something else that you talk about, because I read your article about it a couple of days ago about now, if we're talking about interventions or coping mechanism, are we willing to talk about sex dolls for paedophiles?
Oh, okay.
I think it's
I'm happy to discuss it. I, as you say, I put the I put the article out in a, I think it was last week. I'm happy to discuss it, and I think that there is an argument to be made that for some people it could be a positive thing. I also think that for some other people it could be absolutely disastrous. It's a case of we need to do that research to see whether or not, firstly, are sex doll users actually different from people who don't use sex dolls, both in terms of those who use childlike sex dolls and adult-like sex dolls. Do those two groups differ? And also, do they differ from people who don't use dolls at all? If we find that they don't differ, then that arguably gives us a much more severe ethical headache than if they do, I think, because then what we're saying is if they don't differ in terms of things like sexual fantasy, sexual risk, objectification, then the argument could be made, what is the harm of these kinds of sex dolls? If they do, then we need to figure out under which circumstances would someone who does use a sex doll move on to contact offending. It's not research that has been done. I'm involved in one project at the moment that I can't go into too much detail about. Sure. But we're looking at sex doll users and whether or not they do differ on certain indices compared to non-users. So hopefully that could shed some light on whether there are differences, and then it'll be down to the more clinically minded researchers to figure out what circumstances under which they might become more of a risk.
That sounds like interesting research, and again, very controversial. It'd be good to see what the results come out like.
Hopefully in the summer we'll have a report ready that could be shared. Maybe late summer, early autumn.
If we, let's just bypass the Cyprus soap argument for a second and assume there are no differences. Do you think you're looking at a virtually impossible task of convincing people that it's okay to produce sex dolls that look like children?
Yes, I think so. I think it would be very difficult to convince people that that is something that we should be doing, especially if we're going to be talking about making them commercially available. I can't picture a situation where we could make them commercially available. I think that there could be a situation if we were to be able to identify that they don't differ, or if they could be shown not to be a risk, if they can be shown to not increase people's risk of sexual offending, then we could see them used almost as, I think, Stop SO, which is a charity looking at prevention of sexual abuse, called them maybe prescriptions for sex dolls. And again, that's another controversial issue that hit the headlines over here. But again, people are making these claims without any evidence. So I wouldn't want to do is to start saying, yes, we should be making them available, or no, we shouldn't, based on the fact that we don't have any evidence whatsoever of their effects at the moment.
Yeah, sure. I understand what you're saying. And I guess then that last point you were making is we're talking about them being intervention-based sex dolls, so either in a clinical situation or prescribed almost by a clinician under heavy monitoring, and if that person was not at risk to move on. I guess that's where we're going with that idea.
Yeah, I think with the childlike dolls, definitely. With the adult dolls, I think if we were to find that there isn't a difference in terms of adult doll use, then there's an argument to be made, what's the difference between an adult doll and the emerging kind of virtual reality pornography that we're seeing come through. Now, is there a difference conceptually with that or not? And again, that's an ethical debate for another day, I think.